Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Future Cities podcast. My name is Jason Sauer, and I'm a PhD candidate at Arizona State University working in urban resilience and focused on urban wetlands. Today, I'm going to be talking with Heidi Correa, a researcher who I found through her work on my favorite topics, Valdivia and its wetlands. And in today's episode, we are going to focus on the work contained in her paper titled Self-Organizing Processes in Urban Green Commons, : The Case of the Onguchilla Wetland in Valdivia, Chile. Heidi's work details the history of an organic community movement to protect a specific wetland in a city in southern Chile, Valdivia, and which later turned into a citywide movement and even influenced some legislation that was passed in Chile earlier this year, which basically was the adoption of nationwide protections for urban wetlands. And I wanted to talk with Heidi about her work and the movement in Valdivia, because on this podcast, in academia more broadly, my view is that there's a focus on top-down initiatives for conservation. And my opinion is that whether these initiatives come from NGOs or the government, or even if they were designed by my fellow academics, these initiatives can be deeply problematic in terms of who they represent and what sorts of goals they might pursue. And I envision this episode as being part one in a two-part series, as I hope to have some Valdivians on a later episode to talk about this movement themselves and also about the current state of wetland conservation nationwide and further how all of that ties into urban development. But for now, thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Tiene una pena que no la puedo callar. Son injusticias de siglo que todos ven aplicar. Nadie le pone remedio pudiéndolo remediar. Levántate, buen chula. Okay. So you pronounce it Heidi?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Well, in English, Heidi, but Heidi is like, feels closer to me.
Sure. Okay. Well, I will try that. All right. So I'll start again.
People won't know anyways, but
still, out of respect. Welcome back. I am Jason Sauer, and I'm here talking with Heidi Correa about her paper, Self-Organizing Processes in Urban Green Commons, The Case of the Onguchilla Wetland in Valdivia, Chile. So let's just go ahead and start off with the easy questions. So talk a bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you end up living in Valdivia? What is your degree in? What was your master's degree in? Go ahead.
Okay, we'll try to make it short. I'm from Colombia, from a rural area close to Medellin. I went to school in Medellin. I did my undergrad in petroleum engineering. And when I was in the last year, I went to Oklahoma for an exchange program. And I ended up staying in Oklahoma, doing a master's.
In Oklahoma?
In Oklahoma.
Oh, okay, wow, okay.
So I spent 3 years in Oklahoma. And from there, I moved to Houston to work in the oil industry. So I worked for Shell for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
And when I was in the sixth year, I think, I got cancer. So I had to not quit, but stay away from work for about 6 months. And during that time, all my life went upside down.
Yeah.
And when I went back to work in 2011, I started feeling really uneasy about what I was doing at work. I started asking myself a lot of questions and I started feeling like I'm in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. So about a year and a half from there, I decided to quit. It was so intense. Like I felt really that they didn't get what I was getting. The social responsibility, the environmental responsibility, it was more
in my
mind, it was more a label cleaning thing than an actual thing that they had in their mind.
Okay.
And when I decided to quit, I gave myself a year to figure out what to do. And in the middle of that process, I started someone introduced to me Manfred Max Neff. I watched a few videos of him. He's a Chilean economist that has won several prizes for his alternative economic topics in research. And like almost a year later, I looked at his website, what he was doing and everything, and he posted that he was studying a master, that this year would be the second time they would do this master degree based on his theory that is called human scale development.
Okay.
And ecological economics. And I was like, if life was had sent me a sign, I was like, this is what I need to do. So I applied. My husband was in Germany at the time. And I was like, I don't care. I'm not going to even discuss it. I'm going to apply. I get accepted.
This is what I got to do.
We'll figure this out. And yeah, I got accepted. And a month later, a couple of months later, we were leaving to Valdivia because he decided that he was going to also quit his job and go with it. And we were in the oil industry, so it was easy to do. We had good savings, and it was not like, I mean, going back to school life was pretty easy. So I still remember when I got to Valdivia, because Manfred also worked for Shell, and he quit also. and I was like, I felt so identified that my life was changing because, yeah. Quitting the oil industry was a huge thing for me, but I was really expecting, like, really anxious to see what my life was going to be like. And, yeah, that's how I ended up in Valdivia and how my life started. I don't know. It's still in the process of changing. I don't know. But
sure, sure.
It started there for sure.
Yeah, probably never stops changing. So then you were pursuing a master's degree, and what was that degree ultimately in?
Ah, okay. So the master was called Human Scale Development and Ecological Economics.
And was that at the Australia University of Chile?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it's the same university that sponsored my own research, which is a connection to this. All right. So, I mean, that kind of gets to the general topic of your research, but you ended up really focusing on Valdivia's wetlands and the social movements that surrounded those wetlands. So I guess why? Why were you so interested in that movement?
Well, when I got there, because in my previous life, I had worked mostly on the technical aspects of things. I really felt the need to really dig into this social thing that I felt that Shell was not doing at the time, or that I felt it was not enough. It was more a project-based social responsibility that I wanted to see more, like what it was for people to go to this thing. But initially it was more serendipity, I think, because the university was doing a project to help restore the wetland that was close by my house. And because I was eager to join every single thing I could do.
So
they asked for volunteers to participate in a environmental education class because I had no knowledge about what wetlands were whatsoever. So I joined them and we had to learn a few things, and then we had to develop a project to do social education about the wetland. So then I met the people who had been leaders in the Angachilla movement. And I learned a little bit of the history, what was happening. And I felt that it was like really close. It was almost in my neighborhood. And even though at the beginning, I wanted to do research on energy related stuff, I felt the obligation to continue on the wetland story because it was kind of the more natural thing to do.
Yeah.
I was living there more or less.
Yeah. It's your community.
Yeah.
And just to kind of take a step back for a moment, could you, when you think about Valdivia, like what are the, how would you describe it? Like as a city or like as the natural setting, like how do you remember it?
The first thing I remember is a lot of rain.
Yep.
So for us, it was a big shock because we were coming from Houston.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't really rain much. And this rain was 8 months a year.
Yeah.
And it was some in the winter, it was really horizontal.
Yeah.
Windy. An umbrella wouldn't do anything at all. But I remember Valdivia was really unique for me because it was an university town that when I got there was very active. They had had the issue about the Rio Cruces and the, I forgot the name of the company, the paper
pulp. Yeah, the paper pulp mill, yeah, and the
yeah.
ones, right?
Right. And yeah. So when I got there, that was really still really, really hot. Everybody was talking about it. And I was so impressed about what they had done. They had gone to the European Union. They had talked about it. I was really amazed at the force, right? Mm-hmm. And the natural setting, for me, was amazing. The city itself, I didn't really care much for it. Mm-hmm. But just being there was like everything you needed. You had the sea, like really close. You had this... the Rio Cruces that crossed the city, that was amazing. You had the volcanoes in like 2-3 hours from there. Yeah. It's like a magical place for me, really.
Oh yeah, I 100% agree with that. Like I'm from Kansas and you know, Valdivia was just like not a tropical rainforest, but a temperate rainforest. Mm-hmm. With like the sea lions that are, you know, right at the fish market and that come in. You know, mm-hmm. along that bridge, oh, the university. Yeah. And yeah, like the massive wetland cover in the city. Mm-hmm. But of course, the rain is always like...
the rain. And something funny, I was really crazy into this environmental thinking. In the winter, it gets really cold.
Yes.
And everybody burns wood, mm-hmm. which makes it a big problem in the city. Yeah. Because the smog is horrible. So I was living with my husband and my niece. I decided that we were not going to burn any wood whatsoever.
Okay.
It was so crazy. The poor people in my house were like shivering the whole time. It's like environmental work doesn't have to go to that extreme. We were like suffering the whole winter. It was really cold, but I thought it was better for the environment to suffer this.
Yeah, I went through a similar phase with that where I was like, okay. I mean, number one, I was also just bad at lighting fires in the wood-burning stove and would, uh-huh. you know, have to save all my egg cartons and things like that, you know, to make kindling yeah. for it. And then I was just like, okay, but like the smog is terrible. I have to do something I have to do my part to reduce that. And, you know, like bottle the wool sweaters and the pantuflas, the little slippers.
Yeah.
And, you know, really tried to make that work for me. And then eventually we just bought an electric heater and ate it in the electric bill.
Oh, yeah.
So I understand.
An electric heater and it went like right close to our face.
Yeah, I bought one with a handle so I could bring it with me to like every room as I'm walking through it. Not that I have many rooms, but yeah. Yeah. So, okay. I mean, that pretty well describes it for me too. Like it gets cold there. It doesn't really ever drop below freezing, but it doesn't matter when it's raining on you all the time.
And no, and because the houses are not adapted, they're not insulated.
No.
So you get the humidity inside and it's insane. It's really crazy in the winter, but it's beautiful. The summer is so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. And I mean, even when it's just a light rain, frankly, it's very nice because you're so adapted to like heavy rain. We're like, oh, I can go out in a sprinkle. Who cares? You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll move on from reflecting on how beautiful Valdivia is. Thank you.
All right, so what is so special about the urban wetlands, or what was so special about Valdivia's urban wetlands to you or to like that community in particular?
Yeah, to me, at the beginning, as I told you, I didn't know anything about wetlands. Mm-hmm. For me, they were not in my radar at all. So when I first started working with the local people, I saw things that I never imagined. The connection, this more kind of a spiritual connection to the wetlands. For some people, the wetlands represented spirits, life. And I remember in one talk that I had in university, in some of the world vision of the Mapuche, they say that the rivers have to be free, including wetlands too, and connect all the way to the sea, because they believe the souls, when they die, they go through the rivers to the sea, and from the sea go to heaven. So if they're disconnected, the souls won't go to heaven, mm-hmm. kind of. Right? Yeah. So I started seeing all these really strong connections that were not rational. No, mm-hmm. no, they were not naming biodiversity or flood reduction.
Yeah.
They were, for them, was like beauty, was more into the cultural services, right? Was really, they were really passionate about defending it because they belong to them, right? It was kind of a more intrinsic evaluation of nature. So for me, that was the first thing that really struck. In the city, I think there were many things. I mean, there was this symbolic meaning, also because they had all these swans, the black neck swans that were there, and then because of the pulp, they died. So it was like really shocking to them. They loved it. The black neck swans were kind of a symbol of the city. And to see all of them, like I remember people saying when this incident happened, that the black neck swans were flying, dropping dead in the backyards.
Oh my God.
And so it was something really, really shocking. So it was a symbolic.
Yeah.
A symbolic really attachment to the wetlands in general. But it was also because of this heavy rain, the city floods a lot.
Yeah.
And the wetlands help keeping the city afloat, let's say. So yeah. It has all of those aspects.
Yeah, and I just want to add a quick point on that, because this came up in a conversation with a scientist who was coming through Valdivia when I was there, who was giving a talk on, I don't know, something more in the biotech realm. Mm-hmm. And they had taken this scientist out on the wetlands in like a boat of some type. And mm-hmm. It just happened to run into her. And because we're two English speaking people, she was talking to me and she was like, oh, I wish people, you know, like recognized how useful or like how great these wetlands are. And my response was like, oh, they know, like they yeah. really know. Like yeah. there's a real genuine appreciation. I can't talk to anyone and be like, oh yeah, I'm studying how the wetlands potentially reduce, you know, flood risk or something like that, and have that be in any way interesting to anyone, because they know, like yeah. it's not like a novel idea. Like it's just accepted as fact yeah. there. So yeah, I was really impressed by the depth of understanding and like the real, like genuine appreciation, even beyond the sort of like ecosystem service of yeah. water management. I was really struck by that. So yeah.
And one more thing that I just remembered, because there was also another aspect that I think helped make visible another component of the mm-hmm. wetland thing, is these companies who were building houses, some of them social houses, some of them just commercial houses, they were building some of them like really close to the wetlands. And yes. you could tell, like, we got, because of the wetland, a lot of the social injustice and inequality was visible, because some of the houses these people bought, like they spend all their savings, their pensions or everything, or starting their lives, they were breaking apart because they built it so close to the wetland that it was not stable enough, and they were getting really bad humidity in the house, or the walls were tearing. And I remember when I joined the movement, all these things were being discussed. It's like they're just don't care enough because they're in kind of in the not in the peripheral area, right? Yeah. And they keep building it so close to the wetlands, and people keep investing their money. And then when the problems happen, they're not so easy to recover.
Yeah.
And so that was another aspect that I thought was very interesting, because the wetland was part of the geography of Valdivia. I mean, the wetlands were everywhere. And they were using them as cheap land to build.
Yep.
And the problems that generated with these housing projects were like not really, were not politicizing us, I would say.
Yeah.
Ya rugen las elecciones, escuchan por no dejar, pero el quejido del indio nunca se habrá de escuchar, por más que entren en la tumba la voz de Caucao.
Okay, so the history of the Angachilla wetland and how it got started, I think at the beginning it had to do with this other crisis that the Rio Cruces wetland was experiencing, because there was a big citywide movement to stop the pulp mill and I think at the point Valdivia identified even more with the wetlands, and it was like a social narrative that was constructed. So now the wetlands were in the spotlight.
Yeah.
But for Angachilla, for that specific area, when this whole thing started, the social movement started around 2000, when they constructed a few social projects and commercial projects, housing projects, and the people moved there. And it was so pretty. They had the wetland in the backyard. They had a lot of, like a little forest by the border. Mm-hmm. And so people were really, like, really enjoying their nature in their backyard.
Yeah.
They were going there, picking up edible fruits, picking up medicinal herbs, and just enjoying the wetland, because that segment of the wetland also had a lot of blackneck swans.
Mm-hmm.
So
beautiful.
Beautiful. And it was on one of the latest, like, farther areas to develop in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not like there was not a lot of infrastructure, so it felt really green.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people moved there, and like within the first year or two, someone started cutting some of the trees. And these were centennial trees, a tree that for some people had a symbolic attachment. And they were like, what's going on? So they started feeling that what they had taken for granted that was there for them was not really that. And a lot of vandalism started. A lot of, like, people were burglaring and hiding in the wetland. They were throwing trash. So this whole thing about, there was like a vacuum in governance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they organized themselves, especially because of the vandalism, they organized themselves to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the leader of this Junta de Vecinos, neighborhood committee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was like really sensitive about the wetland. And he thought the wetland was an opportunity to reduce vandalism. Like, let's make this place prettier and more accessible to people, so mm-hmm. it doesn't act as a hiding place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they started. So they did a lot of activities. They applied for projects. They contacted people in the university, the Austral, Universidad Austral. And they really like changed the whole scenery around there. They put benches and observation points. It was like completely a different place. Mm-hmm. They even got a grant from the owner of the green area nearby the wetland to manage it for a year. So it was, everything was really going. They were really painting murals.
Murals, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Murals, and it became an icon. Like after the Rio Cruces one, that was like the big thing. This became like an icon. Everybody wanted to work there. A lot of university students helped.
I do want to say, so like the criminal or the vandalism part of the wetlands is something that comes up a lot in the United States with regard to tree planting, actually. So like there are communities in the US that are resistant to planting of trees because they're worried that the additional shade or the lack of lighting that creates can kind of create spots that are, you know, locations of crime or whatever. So when I read about this and the vandalism and so forth in the wetlands, I thought that was an interesting sort of parallel. And I thought it was a potentially interesting counter narrative to that, because it's not, you know, crime is not created by natural spaces. It's created by issues of governance or social interactions or things like that. I mean, it's a socially defined action to begin with, crime. So I thought this was great in terms of like, this was actually a community action to kind of reject the wetlands as being places of crime and seeking out, additional resources to help them kind of convert it to something else, which I think is a very useful lesson that we can learn in the United States, because I know a lot of researchers just kind of throw their hands up at like, well, we can't put trees there. And it's like, trees aren't creating crime, because there are wealthy neighborhoods with plenty of shade, you know, that don't have to worry about it. The issue is probably somewhere else and you should look there, basically. Anyway, that's my little soapbox. So we'll go on. So I guess, could you talk about the next stage then?
Yeah, so there was a stage. So these things were hardly driven by this very charismatic leader. He was really like friends with everybody. And one thing that I discovered when I was doing the interviews to the community is that they ended up helping him in this cause because they like him.
Yeah.
So it was not something, for some people it was, but for the majority, it was more loyalty or a sentiment of helping out whoever is on the lead in the community. So when he stepped down of his role, everything stopped.
Yeah.
Because the new leader just was very political leader. This is a problem with this community neighborhood committees, because they get very politicized. And so they had a different agenda, and all of a sudden the wetland was like a topic of the past.
But
this leader, he really had passion for the protection of the wetland. He kept trying to work in the background with other people. They even conformed an ecological committee to keep working on the side without having to have that political presence. But for a few years, that whole process that had so much energy stopped. And then I describe it in the paper that I think crises are very important, because crises help to reset, concentrate the energy back into the social movement. And so I think it was 2013. I don't remember the date, but the government of the region, they presented a plan to put a a highway, a beltway that would cross the wetland. And this initially we're planning just to fill the wetland to make it more simple construction.
Yeah.
And when the people in the community knew, it was amazing. Like everybody wanted to help and everybody was protesting. All of a sudden the wetlands topic reactivated, and it reactivated more strongly because now there were more people involved outside the community,
mm-hmm.
more in the university, more friends of this leader. And there was an organization called Biosfera that also worked with other communities who were trying to rescue the green areas, like mm-hmm. the urban creeks and things like that. And so they joined forces to make this massive protest to stop the circunvalación, it was called, the circunvalación going through to the wetland.
Yeah.
And so that whole crisis gave it a really good push. And it all started, and they did a lot of campaigns. They also, at the same time this was happening, there were also more housing projects being built on the other side of the wetland. And they also denounced how they were throwing the debris into the wetland.
Mm-hmm.
That all of this was causing, they already had built a road that had almost disconnected a segment of the Agachilla wetland. And they showed how the connectivity was important, how much of the biodiversity had left.
Yeah.
So it changed a little bit. I think it went to a higher scale. It left the community. It left the neighborhood.
Yeah. Right?
So the narrative was at the beginning, like, this is our wetland.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it spread out to the city.
Yeah.
And so I think that was, I also talk in the paper that it was good and bad because it changed the language.
Sure.
And the purpose and the objectives. And so some of the people that live in Agachilla started feeling disconnected of the whole movement.
Right, it got
because it
too
started
big.
Turning, it started turning technical, it started turning political, and they were like, we're fine here, and we don't want to go that far.
Yeah, and not to completely interrupt here, but can you talk mm-hmm. about the sort of like tactics that the community was originally mm-hmm. using to get broader attention? Like, were they doing protests in like the main square or, murals? I mean, because like, I think there's a pretty big difference between, well, there can be in some cases, certainly, between like how organization works in Valdivia, certainly, mm-hmm. and in Chile in general, compared to the United States and some other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, can you talk a bit about like what the specific actions were that you remember?
Yeah. At the beginning, when the whole movement was contained in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. it was more less brightened up, right? So let's show the good side, let's paint murals, let's do cultural activities, let's spend, they have a cultural night. They mm-hmm. brought the orchestra to play in the garden.
Wow.
And so it was more kind of less being in love with this wetland, right?
Yeah, you're right. Very positive, very, sort of connection.
Very positive.
Yeah.
But when this plan to construct the road happened, I felt a lot of anger.
Yeah.
In a way. They were feeling the same fear that happened with the pulp mill,
mm-hmm.
that the power is given to the big corporations or the interest, because this road was not any road. This road was connecting the inland forest sector where they were doing all these forest plantations.
Yep, the eucalyptus.
Monocultures, eucalyptus mm-hmm. and pine.
Yep.
And connecting it to the ports. In the coast.
Yes. Yep.
So it was like they're doing it again. They're giving priority to the interests of the big companies,
which
is the same companies anyways.
Yeah, which are usually internationally owned too, if I remember correctly from the region. Yeah.
Right. And they felt anger because they felt that the government didn't really listen. They didn't take them into account when they proposed this road. And at the beginning, the government said, we're going to do it like this. They didn't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So the tactics they used, they put lawsuits. They demanded the process that was going on, especially with the housing projects. They painted banners. They went to the city center. They were very, very visible. They went to the radio. The newspaper there was a really interesting point for how do you call it, bringing up their voices.
Yeah. Are you talking Diario Austral or are you talking
El Austral. Mm-hmm. And they started, you know, doing all of these small segments on what was going on, and it became a political topic. Mm-hmm. It became a political topic to the point that a lot of the politicians visited. They promised, they promised all these great things about changing things. And they also did something interesting as well, that they joined. So this problem is not just Bolivia, but in a lot of places in Chile, they have these issues that wetlands have this issue about them, that they haven't been valued enough. They look like a swamp.
Yes.
Right? So for many people, these are places, underproductive places that should be explored. And so governments are still kind of trying to understand why they're important. And this group of people join a network of wetland protection organizations around the country. Mm-hmm. So they were doing seminars, they were doing all these joint things that also gave them more visibility, because now other regions were talking about Angasilla wetland, and the discussion was raising levels. But still, I don't know what the status of the road. Because when I left, they said they were going to do a bridge, then they said they were not going to do it, then they said they were starting to do it in a different place.
Different area, yeah.
Yeah. Oh. So I don't know where it is.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and keep talking about this last phase that you describe in your paper.
Right. So the last phase had to do with more of a feeling that the urban wetlands in Valdivia, who was already, so the term urban wetlands, mm-hmm, was already installed in the city. More, they had a name, was Urban Natural Reserves. Right?
Yes, yeah.
So they use this name to kind of collect all the different urban areas that had spots of natural life, little creeks or little forests in the city, the wetlands. Mm-hmm. And they started to notice, especially with the wetlands, that they were filling up. They were filling some areas up without saying anything about it. So one of these areas that started, created the next level was in Isla Teja. Isla Teja,
yes,
was a sector in Valdivia that was more, a little bit more wealthy. And it also was where the university was. So it got a lot more attention. And it was an indigenous community who lived there, who were friends with this leader that started the whole thing in Angasilla. Mm-hmm. And they were asking for help because they, like, in their backyard, they were doing some construction work that was filling up part of a wetland. And they said, this is a wetland, this is not legal, because the wetlands are usually classified as flooding zones that can be built with limitations, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have very limited construction that can be done to them. So they raised this topic, and the rest of the people who had been working in wetlands or urban national reserves, they started helping out to find out what it was. So what happened, they discovered that the zoning of this specific part of town was initially a flooding zone where you cannot build, but the municipal council had changed it to construction with restrictions.
Yeah, yep.
Which means that they were kind of paving the road for this to be, I think they were going to build down. I don't know. I think it was a building. They were trying to build
in. Probably there. Apartments or something in there.
Probably apartments, yeah. And when they started discovering these things, they feel like they felt, because I was already part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that this was like so outrageous. They really got angry at the system, because now it was not just Angatilla, it was not just Rio Cruces. It was like the whole city. This was a systemic issue.
Yes.
And so that's when I think the whole thing moved to a very interesting level, because now they were organized, or we were organized, in a citywide objective that included people from all these other causes that had happened through time and still hadn't been solved. And they started really pushing, this time, the local government for action, which in the past they had done, but kind of indirectly, more through protests and more through letters and the diary, the newspaper. But now they faced the government directly. They asked for, in Valdivia, there is a participation law that you can talk to, ask for a session with the council,
mm-hmm.
and you just bring up your issues, and they had to give you an answer in, I think it's a month or something like that. So they brought it to the council, and they showed the issues that were happening, how they were changing the zoning plans, how many of the wetlands were being modified without the permission.
Yeah.
And also they showed how crazy the system was, because some ministers had to do with the water flooding issues. Some other ministers had to do with another aspect. But all of them had like broken laws here and there,
mm-hmm.
that none of them could actually do a job to the job of helping or avoiding the wetlands from being modified.
Right.
And so they started a discussion, really political. It was very intense, to the point that the senator that represents that region in Valdivia got involved. And they, because also they had all this network around the country of other wetlands that were being modified or they were trying to protect.
Yeah, under similar circumstances.
They push to promote a law for protecting urban wetlands,
mm-hmm.
which is when I left. It was being discussed in the Senate, but it was not still finalized.
Un día llego de afuera, huéspede conquistador, buscando montañas de oro que el indio nunca buscó. Al indio le basta el oro que le.
The quest
do I think is important?
Yeah, I mean, like the concept of the Green Commons, do you find it particularly useful or relevant to, you know, this situation and then elsewhere for building these kind of movements or really thinking about rights and, I don't know, uses of these spaces that are, you know, we all have in common?
Yeah, I think it's critical, actually. What I talk in the paper is, it's complicated because in particular the wetland I work with is something I call a contested common, right? So normally the studies about commons, there is a fishery, a well-known fishery, it has limits, and they're just trying to organize how to manage it. But the property rights are usually not a problem. And in the case of the wetlands, not only the property rights are a problem, the definition itself of the wetland is a problem.
Yes.
What is a wetland and for who?
Yeah.
Because for the community, the wetland was not just the water. It was all the riverbank, let's call it.
Yeah.
It was the green area around it. And it was not just the portion of the wetland that surrounded their neighborhood, because they're interconnected.
Yes.
If it gets disconnected somewhere else, you lose the biodiversity right there. So it's a more kind of neural kind of way of thinking it. And so it gets more complicated, because where do you put the limits? Mm-hmm. How do you define it so you have a good governance?
Yeah.
That granted that when it's in public area, it's somewhat easier. But when it's in private area, in Chile, like in many countries, private property is like at the foremost, is like the most important priority.
Yes.
Everything comes down from it. So it's complicated. It's complicated to make it to define it in a way that is protected for the right reasons. Because one thing that I also kind of touch on in the paper is, well, the common kind of idea has to do with not with using the common as a verb, right? As an action. It's not waiting for something to be given to you for management so you can manage it. But things become common when they have common uses and when they have common valuation. But so do the housing companies. They also, they could organize themselves and see this land as a common, but in a different, with a different objective. And on the other side are the communities who value it also for very different reasons. For some, it's this intrinsic valuation that is hard to grasp, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to sell, because what I feel like when I did some of the interviews, I understood why people in Shell didn't get it. It's really hard to get.
Yeah.
my feeling about why this tree is important, that this is like a legacy. I remember one of the interviewees, she was telling me, what is done to this wetland is done to me. I feel it. I cry. So that's non-negotiable. Like, how do you say, no, do just a little bit and then live with the other half that was left. It's like it's part of your life. And so the common is very important, I think, because it helps bring these narratives or why it's important to me. But as I showed in the paper, the problem is when it becomes very political, you start going back to a rational strategies.
Yeah.
And the rational strategies are biodiversity, climate change, flood reduction.
Yeah.
Things that they're important, but they cannot, even with cultural ecosystem services, you cannot grasp the depth of the feeling that some people have about the natural places.
Mm-hmm.
And how it is important not just to do a little bit, is to leave it intact, to leave it as it is. And so I think it's important, trying to summarize the idea, I think it's important to think in the common sense from the fact that it's a verb, and it's also dynamic, and it's evolving, and that the ownership, I think it this way, ownership is not just given by title, by property.
Mm-hmm.
Ownership has to do with use. Ownership has to do with valuation and appreciation. But then in the real world, it becomes really difficult because of the private property laws that exist. But at least I think it can help to start the process, right?
Yeah.
I don't think the commoning, I mean, we think, for example, I've been hearing for a while the commoning about the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
You know, this greenhouse effects and all that. Even though it's really hard to grasp in a political world, I think it can help in the long term to make visible the caring, the more intrinsic caring.
Yeah.
The caring that doesn't have to do with profit or doesn't have to do with the strategy. It's really, I think that's one of the things that I really discovered in life, that caring is something kind of for some people, especially in Valdivia, I found that a lot. The caring because of intrinsic reasons that you might be able to put in a paper, but it still doesn't go even half of the way.
Yeah, it's totally flat, like in a text version, but goes way beyond it when you're, describing someone's like actual inner life about, you know, whatever the object is or area or whatever.
And so, I don't know because like, I remember being in Shell, sitting in meetings and hearing these people say, laughing in an ironic sense, why do they care so much? We're giving them money.
Yeah, right.
And why are they asking for so much compensation if we're already getting this and this? I think it's important to bring these other narratives that are more about, it's like, why do you love your kid or your pet?
Right,
it's something.
Here are the services they're providing you. You're not going to get all of them, but we're maximizing these or whatever. And it's like, no.
Right, exactly. And I felt that there. I felt that they care. Some people care about these wetlands in a way that is existential.
Yeah. I'm really glad I ended up asking this question, because this is one of the things that I really think about a lot with regard to ecosystem services, because I'm constantly doing that. This is like what has really taken over in academia and in the circles that I'm in, basically. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's like, I forget how many categories that got recognized in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessments or whatever. Yeah. And then there's like in the cultural services, they have like
three,
spiritual, aesthetic. And there's the three in there. And I remember just like looking at those and like, not only are they at the bottom of the page and they're small in terms of the amount of space they take up on that page.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, well, how do you compare that to, something like provisioning services like lumber or something like that? And I'm like, mm-hmm. but this is the most critical section for me. As like a person, like these, this tiny area that's not well explained at all is the reason I'm doing this job in the first place. You know, like I don't care about lumber yields or things like that. That's never been like the motivator for it.
And the problem is that as I perceived it, like in Shell, they don't get it. So the housing companies, it's not even to judge them. The model works like that. They're working for profit and they compensate with money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as they go. And I think it's still, at least when I was there, there was not a feeling that they're being sensibilized enough on this topic, on how things are important intrinsically.
Yeah.
And there's not like the MasterCard ad, that like there's something you can buy with MasterCard, but there's some things that they you can't.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't know if companies will ever evolve because given this private property protection, they always end up having more agency. They have a lot more agency. They even sponsor some of the seminars about these wetlands, like they have a lot more spotlights, and more to say. So that we'll see how that goes.
Well, thank you so much. I think this is probably everything that I have, unless there's something else that you wanted to talk about. Okay. This was great. This got onto a lot of topics that I hadn't really thought that we would get onto. And I'm very happy to have done that in this episode.
I'm very existentialist, so.
Good.
You always end up like this.
I appreciate that you had your existential crisis and that is filled out and continues on in the rest of your work.
The Future Cities podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, or UREX as we usually refer to it. To learn more about UREX, visit www.sustainability.asu.edu/urban-resilience. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.